Tim.
Let me try that again. So our hymn today...
Where's our Tim?
Is a mighty fortress is our God. do we have a Tim?
You said you were going to display a Tim to us. So, I mean, I would assume so now.
I mean, we can't.
You guys know a mighty fortress is our God, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Martin Luther? Yeah, you'll recognize it. We sang it, or did we sing it this past VBS? I don't know if we ever actually found a version that we liked enough to use.
I know you guys were searching for it a lot, but I don't think you guys actually found one.
Okay. Well, we'll use mine, because I like my version.
Oh.
All right. So, here we go.
So this isn't the traditional one?
Wait.
It is, pretty much. It's just a little upbeat. A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing. Our helper, he amidst the flood of mortal ills prevailing. For still our work us woe, his craft and power are great, and armed with cruel hate. On earth is not his equal. Did we in our own strength confide, our striving right man on our side, the man of God's own choosing. Must ask who that may be. Christ Jesus, it is he. Lord Sabaoth, his name, from age to age the same.
Fortress this week?
Why were we going to do it last week?
It was Sunday.
Yeah, what was happening last week on October 31st? Don't say Halloween.
Last week? Was like,
and don't say Game 7 of the World Series, because those things were happening. But.
Wait, Sunday was the 31st?
I don't remember. You told us.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Actually, it's when Martin Luther posted his thesis.
Sunday wasn't the 31st.
It was not, but it was the closest day to the October 31st.
October 31st,
96. No.
It was?
What did you say, Jared?
It was.
Oh, okay. Game 6 was on Halloween.
That's right.
Game 7 was Wednesday.
Yeah, that's right.
Game 6 was on this point, too.
True story.
Game 9. That's the real game.
Excuse me. Well, let's make sure we understand the theology here first, and then we'll talk about Martin Luther and, what he did and why he wrote this song. A mighty fortress is our God. A bulwark never failing. What's a bulwark?
Sort of like a
strong wall.
Yeah, a strong wall.
Those little peaks.
Yeah, it's the defensive wall on a castle, right? It's where the archers would stand at the top of it.
I was going to say a male wall. Work.
No.
You could have referenced something on a ship, but that would have...
I mean, the poor.
Our helper, he amid the flood of mortal ills prevailing. What's that sentence mean?
He's our helper in Old English here.
Yeah.
He's our helper even in the midst of a flood of mortal ills.
Yeah. And what mortal ills are we talking about?
Sin.
Death. There we go. For still our ancient foe doth seek to work us woe.
Satan.
Yes. Satan is our ancient foe.
And he's being mean.
He is working against us. So as what is it, Romans 5:8? Is it Romans 5:8? I don't know if it's Romans 5:8. Where you know that our enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Steal, kill, and destroy. His craft and his power are great and armed with cruel hate. On earth is not his equal. Who is he?
No, you have to say cruel. Cruel.
Cruel.
It's not so cruel.
Armed with cruel hate. Who's the he in this sentence? Satan, the devil. On earth is not his equal. Theologically correct?
Yes. Well, not
anymore.
Jesus. But Jesus isn't technically on earth.
Correct, yeah.
Anymore.
He sits at the right hand of the Father.
So yes, it's true.
Did we, in our own strength, confide? Read did as if. That's just the old English way of saying if. So, if we, in our own strength, confide, our striving would be losing. What's he saying?
If we rely on our own strength, we're just going to lose.
Yeah, we're SOL if we try and earn our salvation ourselves.
What does SOL stand for?
Shit out of luck.
I know, I was trying to get that.
Thanks for that, Nathan.
You're welcome.
Scubala out of luck.
Scubala?
It's the Greek for that word.
We're
not the right man on our side.
Jesus!
The squirrel, man of God's own choosing.
Squirrel.
Dost ask who that may be? We've already answered it. Christ Jesus, it is he.
Squirrel.
Lord Sabaoth, his name. What is Lord Sabaoth?
Something about the Sabbath? They just needed it to fit the song?
Sabaoth is the plural of Sabbath. Sabaoth is the plural of Sabbath. But it's Lord of the Sabbaths, like, as in the guy who's in charge of all of the days of rest. As in when Jesus is contending with the Pharisees and they say, why do you not rest on the Sabbath? And he says, the Sabbath was not made for man. And if you knew who you were talking to, you wouldn't be saying this to me because I'm in charge of the Sabbath. Like, I'm kind of the guy who made it up. That's what he's referencing.
Because I literally did it.
Yeah. From age to age, the same. What doctrine or attribute of God is that describing? You remember the big fancy word?
I think.
Nope, but I know.
Is it omnipresence?
No, it's age to age is the same.
How would that be omnipresent?
Calm down. She took a guess.
No. Wrong. Got it.
Do you know what the right one is, Nathan?
No. Satan.
It's his immutability, his unchangingness.
Immutability.
As in, think mute, mutate, like to change.
No, like the
M as in to negate mutation, so not changing. Immutability. It's come from a Latin word.
Or Greek. Everything comes from the Greek.
And he must win the battle. Again, read must as shall or will.
Or has.
Old English way of saying future tense. With assurance.
Must works.
Yeah.
Too.
Well, In our modern English, when we say must, it implies the possibility that it won't happen, but it's a statement of the will that, you know, you must do this in the future, whereas in the older English, must meant it's an assurance that the future thing will occur. That's the slight difference. But yes, must does work, because he's God. He's going to. And though this world with devils filled should threaten to undo us, we will not fear, for God hath willed his truth to triumph through us. Somebody put that into modern English for me.
This world is filled with devils, and they threaten to undo us.
But what's our response going to be?
We're not
going to fear, and why? Why?
Because we have God, we have his word.
Yeah.
Because God hath willed.
Yeah.
His truth to triumph.
His truth to triumph.
God's will is that his truth would triumph on this earth through us. Yeah. The prince of darkness grim, we tremble not for him. His rage we can endure, for lo, his doom is sure. It's one of my favorite lines. Sum it up.
Satan's angry, we can endure. He's going to die.
Yeah, he's going to lick a fire because we've read the end of Revelation.
Also, his wrath is nothing compared to God's.
Due to one word.
Yeah. One little word shall fell him. What word do you think it is?
I don't remember. He told me this before.
Yeah. Any guesses? Probably not what you think.
Little
the one that came to mind is not the one that it is.
What?
I was thinking liar, but in
it is.
It is.
Exact, it's liar.
In the exact way that it was said in The Princess Bride.
Liar!
But it is. Liar is the word that he was thinking of. This is we know this from extra or other texts from Martin Luther when he was expounding on what the hymn was about. The one little word that should fail him is liar. If you call out the truth that he is a liar, he cannot stand. Yeah. That word, liar, above all earthly powers, no thanks to them abideth. What's that mean?
No thanks to them, what is them? Is that the word? Or the people saying the word?
Alright, let's break it down. What does abideth mean?
No thanks to the earthly power?
To dwell.
Yeah,
To dwell, live, we'll go with that. So, them who live, where... Who is the they who are living?
The earthly powers.
Yeah, so either earthly powers, and so the word is from above all earthly powers. Earthly powers, what are the earthly powers, as referenced earlier in this song?
Death.
Yeah, and the devil, and the devils. So, no thanks to them. Like, we don't know this word because of them. They are the ones who've given us this word that puts us in power above them because of it. Who do we thank implicitly? Who told us that the word liar is the one little word that shall fail him?
Jesus Christ, Lord Sabaoth.
Yeah, and the Bible, direct revelation from God. But yeah, God, the triune God is revealed to us. The one little word shall fail him. And we don't have to thank the earthly powers. We thank the godly powers, the above earthly powers. The Spirit and the gifts are ours. Pretty straightforward, yes. Mm-hmm. through him who with us sideth. You may know what text he's referencing for that particular doctrine. What text is it that says that Jesus is the one who bestows the gifts through the Holy Spirit?
Princess Bride is not
the answer. That is true.
Through him who with us sideth, I don't know where it is, but it's if God is for us, who can be against
us? Yeah, that's Romans. And the Spirit and the gifts are ours through Christ would be... I'm just blanking. Ephesians? Ephesians 4, I think. Therefore I am. Somebody look it up. Go to Ephesians 4, see if there's something in there about the gifts that come down from heaven above. Some he gave as apostles, prophets. Should be like halfway through the chapter. Let goods and kindred go, this mortal life also, the body they may kill. What's he telling this, the singers of the song to do?
The things of the earth, like that your belongings, let them go in your life.
Yeah. Don't cling too tightly to them. The body they may kill, they might kill us, but what's going to remain?
God's truth.
And why?
Yes.
Because his kingdom is forever.
One God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. But grace was given to each one of us according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives and he gave gifts to men.
There you go. That's how we know that Jesus is the one by which the Spirit gives the gifts. And that's it. Great hymn. It has lived from 1517 for a reason. Read along with me. Martin Luther was born on November 10th, 1483, in Eilspin, Saxony, then part of the Holy Roman Empire. He was educated at the University of Erfurt, later becoming an Augustinian monk teaching philosophy and theology at the University of Wittenberg. As an Augustinian monk, Luther spent much time in pain. You can erase the word was there, my apologies. Trying to beat his sin into submission. So keenly aware of his depravity and unable to shake it off, Luther began deep study of the word and theology to find the truth about the nature of man. A famous story tells of him spending over 6 hours at confession, to the point that the priest listening to his confession told him, "Luther, go home and love God," to which Luther responded, "Love God? Sometimes I hate him." His despair over his sin drove him to the books of Galatians and Romans, where he found the simple gospel of grace preached by Paul and explained by Augustine. He understood then that no amount of works would save him from his sin. Only God's grace could do that. The doctrine of the grace of God we indebt to Martin Luther, recovering it in the 16th century. Spurred on by other reformers, Wycliffe, Jan Hus, he sort of endeavored to understand the Bible and in the face of Rome being oppressive to him. And this is one of the things that I love about Luther, is, and I wrote it there, so keenly aware of his depravity and unable to shake it off, he studied the God diligently to find out the truth about the nature of man. That, something I've realized about the great men that I admire the faith throughout history is they recognize their depravity. And it is, when you recognize just how nothing you are in the eyes of God because of your sin, that you can accept the wonderful grace of God. And it allows you to remain humble in the midst of being given such a marvelous gift. If you don't recognize how much of a sinner you are, you cannot recognize how big grace is. And if you don't understand how big grace is, you're not going to be able to experience the goodness of God in your life as fully.
I don't think you'll kind of think
it's
the brain of the thing.
Exactly.
You don't have any appreciation for it.
So Luther was one of those guys who's being taught by Rome, earn your salvation, not in so many words, but through actions. And he can't. He goes to confession and he's trying to confess all of the sins that he's thought, and he knows that he has crucified Christ with his actions every day. And he stumbles upon Galatians and Romans, realizing You can't earn your salvation. It has to be just given to you. That's what grace is. And so he recovered that doctrine. On October 31st, 1517, sometimes called the 4th of July of Protestantism, Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Cathedral of Wittenberg, Germany. These theses condemned various practices and teachings of the Roman Church which contradicted the gospel of grace. He spent years confronting and refuting a leading offender in the Roman Catholic Church on the sale of indulgences for profit, Johann Tetzel. After several years of stormy disputes with the Roman Catholic Church and its leaders, Martin Luther was finally excommunicated from the fellowship of the Roman Catholic Church in 1520 at the Diet of Worms. It was here he made his famous statement, "Unless I am convinced by the testimony of the Holy Scriptures, or by evident reason, for I can believe neither Pope nor councils alone, as it is clear that they have erred repeatedly and contradicted themselves, I consider myself convicted by the testimony of the Holy Scripture, which is my basis. My conscience is captive to the word of God. Thus I cannot and I will not recant, because acting against one's conscience is neither safe nor sound. God help me. Amen." He probably didn't say, "Here I stand, I can do no other," even though that's famous. That's the famous quote. But the gist of it was there. One of the important benefits of the Reformation was the rediscovery of congregational singing. Luther had strong convictions about the use and power of sacred music. He expressed his convictions in this way: "If any man despises music, as all fanatics do, for him I have no liking. For music is a gift and grace of God, not an invention of men. Thus it drives out the devil and makes people cheerful. Then one forgets all wrath, impurity, and other devices." In another place, "I wish to compose sacred hymns so that the word of God may dwell among the people also by means of songs. And again, I would allow no man to preach or teach God's people without a proper knowledge of the use and power of sacred song." The single most powerful hymn of the Protestant Reformation movement was Martin Luther's "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," based on Psalm 46 and 18. This hymn became the battle cry of the people, a great source of strength and inspiration even for those who were martyred for their convictions. This hymn has been translated into practically every known language and is regarded as one of the noblest and most classic examples of Christian hymnody. It is said that there are no less than 60 translations of this text in English alone. In England, a version by Thomas Carlyle is in general use, while in the U.S. the translation by Friedrich H. Hague, a professor at Harvard University, is most frequently. This translation was not made until 1852, and it first appeared in the book entitled Gems of German Verse by W.H. Furness, published in 1853. The first line of this national hymn of Protestant Germany is fittingly inscribed on the tomb of the great reformer at Wittenberg, and may still be read with appreciation by travelers to that historic spot. You guys know anything about Luther? Or heard any stories about him? Studied him at all in school?
I did at school. Then I continued studying other things in history, and I forget some other things.
Luther is one of the key players of the Reformation. One of the reasons you're Protestant is because of Martin Luther. And he was not without his faults. He was a very, very brash man. It kind of comes through in a few places. He was the kind of guy who spoke first and asked questions later. Say anything he had to win an argument, sort of thing. Very non-PC viewpoints, particularly towards the end of his life. Most people think he was suffering from some sort of mental disease developed at the end of his life. But he had some very, very anti-Semitic things to say towards the end of his life. Part of it brought on by he tried to reunite Jews and Protestants under Jesus. And, of course, the Jews in Germany didn't want anything to do with him because they don't accept Jesus as the Messiah. So when they refused his sort of offer of an olive branch, he retaliated strongly, sort of, yeah. You can read some of his stuff on the Jews. He's a very controversial figure. It's also famously quoted, in case you hear this, that he thought that the Book of James was not inspired, shouldn't be in the Bible. That's not really true. It's something that he said in passing during like an argument at dinner one night. He would have students of his over for dinner all the time, drink beer, and argue. And so it's one of those things where like he was losing an argument and somebody quoted James to him. And he's like, James, the Epistle of Straw, I don't even know why it's in the Bible. He didn't actually believe that it shouldn't be in the Bible. He was just trying to dismiss an opposing viewpoint, because that's what you do in an argument, and that's what he did quite often.
So he just really hated to lose.
Yes. That very much describes Martin Luther to a T. The man hated to lose. Anyway. Interesting fellow, worth reading. We are indebted to him for recovering the gospel of grace. That's Martin Luther and A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. How are we doing on top? We got a little over an hour.
I think I remember. Okay, this is weird. You wouldn't think that you would sing this song in Catholic Church, but I think I remember singing it growing up.
Really?
But I have to check to make sure. I really don't know. Because it doesn't make sense that that would be. I mean, Martin Luther's like.
Yeah.
They don't like it, do they?
Really, I mean, the Counter-Reformation in the Catholic Church that happened after Luther essentially is like, 40 years later they came along and was like, Luther actually had a few good points. Like, we could probably make some changes.
But we didn't want to tell him that.
Yeah.
Give him the satisfaction.
We're just going to wait 40
years. Well, and all those people
years.
That were killed because they were standing up.
So, I think a little bit, like, I mean, if you talk to Catholics today, or if you go look at the Lutheran Church today, it looks a whole lot more like the Catholic Church than the Protestant Church does.
It looks more Catholic than Protestant, is that what you're trying to say? Yeah, definitely. A lot of those mainline churches do. That one, Presbyterian, is very liturgical.
Correct.
Those are the two that I know, that I've been to personally, that I've seen.
We could get into a whole different discussion about that.
Cool. Hey.
So if you have your notes from the last time we met, we're going to finish up Hosea, because we left off fairly quickly after getting the context. Somebody remember to summarize the context for me?
Oh, I have my towel over here.
Of Hosea? Each
of his children represented.
Yeah, chapters 1 and 2 were essentially God telling Hosea, go get a prostitute, marry her, have kids with her. And so she has kids, and each one gets named different things that represent Israel in various capacities. Pens, anyone? Pens? Anyone else?
Why
pens?
Is Lo Amai or whatever? Why does he have black hair instead of blonde hair?
Don't know. Pens, anyone? Anyone else? Pens? Pens.
That's probably a more accurate color than the other two.
It's true.
Where are we comparing them to? Are they...
No, the Jews are dark complexion. They're Semitic people, so they're not going to be blonde. That's
one. So, he had three kids. First one named Jezreel. Why was he named Jezreel? Yeah. That's not what Jezreel means, though.
But it's the general concept. Yahweh will destroy Jacob's line and all of Israel.
There you go. What did you say? Yahweh will finish that?
Destroy Jehu's line and all of Israel.
Yahweh will destroy Jehu's line and all of Israel. Jehu started his sort of rise to power, anointed by God, in the valley of Jezreel. He had a very, very bloody rise to power. He went through and killed, we're actually going to learn some of it in Joel, when he set up Joel, but went through and killed both the kings of Judah and Israel, and then killed all of the prophets of Baal, all of the royal family in Israel, all of the children and wives in Israel. And he set up shop, and he became king in Israel in the north. And so he also had this kind of, the way he killed all of the priests, he said, you know, I'm going to worship Baal too, guys. Come on in. Let's go have like this big Baal worshiping party. He got all the priests in, and he had, you know, archers standing. Yeah. Had Archer standing there ready to close the doors.
It's Valentine's Day.
Yeah. I was thinking more the Red Wedding from Game of Thrones. But it was very much like that. If you go read 2 Kings 10 through 14, it's very action-packed, put it that way. So that's why it's named Jezreel. The bloodiness of Jehu's rise to power in Israel and the subsequent idolatry and evil that followed Jehu's line started in the Valley of Jezreel. So when God says, name of Jezreel, I'm going to destroy Jehu's line, it's reference to that evil. Lo Ruhama literally means
no love or pity.
As in, God will no longer have compassion or love on Israel.
Here comes the love or pity.
Lo Ami means not my people, so he's disowning the people of Israel, saying, you're not going to be mine anymore.
Those kids might not have been the nicest kids.
So that is where we left off in chapter 1. So we'll pick up in chapter 2. Chapter 1 ends with kind of this weird switch of, he's been saying you're not my people, and then he finishes off with a promise. And he's like, where are you?
11.
Yeah, 11. And the children of Judah and children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head, and they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Verse 10 was what I was looking for. And the place where it said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God, you are my people. Chapter 2 then sort of lays into, here's what the punishment's going to look like. Punishment and restoration elucidated. So somebody wanted to read for me chapter 2, verses 1 through 13. Read them real quick.
Say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved one, rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. Otherwise, I will strip her naked and make her as bare as on the day she was born. I will make her like a desert, turn her into a parched land, and slay her with thirst. I will not show my love to her children, because they are the children of adultery. Their mother has been unfaithful, and she has conceived them in disgrace. She said, I will go after my lovers, who give me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. Therefore, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers, but not catch them, and she will look for them, but not find them. Then she will say, I will go back to my husband as at first, for then I was better off than now. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore, I will take away my grain when it ripens, and my new wine when it is ready. I will take back my wool and my linen, intended to cover her nakedness. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals, her new moons, her Sabbath days, all her appointed feasts. I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were her pay from her lovers. I will make them a thicket, and wild animals will devour them. I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry, and went after her lovers. But me she forgot, declares the Lord.
All right. Who's he talking to?
Hosea.
And who does he tell Hosea to talk to?
Her
brother. Yeah, say to your brothers, you are my people, and to your sisters, you have received mercy. So who are Hosea's brothers and sisters?
Israel.
Yeah, people of Israel. Blah, 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 blah. However, that's also the name of his kids, right? Lo Ami, you are not my people. So say to your brothers, you are my people. Say to your sisters, Ruama, you have mercy. So there's this question of, is he talking to his kids, or is he supposed to be, is this talking to the people of Israel? The point is, this is an allegory. This chapter 2, it's an allegory. Define an allegory for me, anyone?
Isn't it like a long metaphor?
Yeah, it's an extended metaphor. It's a story where the characters represent some other thing in reality. It's just a story metaphor. So in this story metaphor, who is the mother, the woman that he's talking to? Israel, yeah. The nation as a whole, Judah in particular. Or excuse me, Israel in particular, northern kingdom of Israel. So plead with her, let her put away her whoring from between her breasts. I'm going to, or if she doesn't, I'm going to strip her naked, make her as in the day she was born, wilderness, make her like a parched land, kill her with thirst. I'm going to make life pretty awful for her if she does not put away her harlotry whoring. So what is the harlotry whoring in this allegory?
Worshipping other gods.
Yeah, worshipping other gods. Where does that come through clearest? Hit verse 8. Yeah. What's the phrase where that comes through the clearest?
She has not acknowledged me, basically. It's not the one that I gave.
Yeah.
I'm the one that gave her what she has.
Yeah. And what does she do with it?
Which they used in worshiping Baal.
Yeah. So the metaphor breaks there, right? He switches back into, here's what I'm describing. When Israel went and started worshiping Baal. That's how you know.
Well, I will punish her for the festival days when she burned incense to the Baal idols.
Yeah.
After her lovers, but she forgot me.
So this is what God's going to do to Israel because they've been all idolatrous. He's going to make their life awful. He's going to strip them naked, take everything away from them, lay them waste. Verse 14, therefore I will... Behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. And there I will give her vineyards and make the valley of Achor a door of hope. And there she shall answer as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. What is the time when she came out of the land of Egypt?
When Moses. Israel came out of Egypt.
Yeah, there you go. The Exodus. Verse 14. So, and in the day that declares the Lord, you will call me my husband, and no longer will you call me my Baal, for I will remove the names of Baals from your mouth; they shall be remembered no more. What's he going to do? Yeah. Verse 18, and I will make for them a covenant on that day. With the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, the creeping things on the ground, and I will abolish the bow and the sword and war from the land, and I will make you lie down in safety, and I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice and steadfast love and mercy. I will betroth to you me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. What's God going to do with Israel?
He's going to come and live with
her. Going to come take her back. You're going to marry her. In this allegory. Verse 21, and in that day I will answer, declares the Lord, I will answer in the heavens, and they shall answer the earth, and the earth shall answer with grain, the wine, the oil, and they shall answer Jezreel, and I will sow for her myself in the land, and I will have mercy on no mercy. So I will have Ruama on Lo Ruama. I will say to Lo Ami, Ami. I'll tell the people who are not my people, my people. And they shall say, you are my God.
So is this like foreshadowing?
There you go. What time period is being described when this is going to happen? When Israel will be taken back by God and when they will say to him, you are my God again.
But I was more talking about the people who aren't my people sort of thing. Or is it just talking about what was...
Yeah, that's just a reference to the name of the kids.
Well, I realize that, but is it still only talking about Israel, or is it... I guess that would be the only thing.
There you go. So, in the original context, we're thinking Israel, I'm going to, so, but you bring up a good point. What we're going to see in most of the Minor Prophets is there's going to be these spots where God promises something to this nation that he's just promised judgment on. He promises judgment, and then he promises some sort of restoration, some sort of hope. So the question is, what period of hope is he talking about? Two major possible answers to this usually fall in. You remember this timeline? What's this represent?
Babylon.
Babylon, exile to Babylon. And what's this represent?
The return.
The return. So in here, they're rebuilding the temple, they're reestablishing Israel, building the wall, Nehemiah, and then Christ comes and sets up the church. So perhaps he's talking about this period. The judgment that's coming is this, or this, and the promises that are being spoken of are this, when they return to the land of Israel, when they reestablish themselves as a nation. That's one option. That's how most Reformed theologians would interpret this. They say, these promises have been fulfilled. This talk of reuniting himself with Israel, that happened in 444 when Nehemiah came back and when Ezra came back to the land of Israel. I do not think that that's the case. I think that the better answer is that these are going to be fulfilled and have not yet been fulfilled in the end times. Millennial kingdom. You guys remember the millennial kingdom?
Thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ.
Thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ. It's after the tribulation, and it's a time for Israel to experience all of the promises given in the prophets. And hopefully I'll make it clear why I think that is as we go through and see some of these promises. Let's... They shall have grain well, and they shall be able to show people. So, chapter 3 is real short. So I'm going to read that, and then we will sort of sprint through the rest of the book of Hosea. Let me get back to you. The Restoration Illustrated. And the Lord said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes over raisins. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and an omer and a lethek of barley. And I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore or belong to another man. So will I also be to you. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. All right. There's actually quite a bit in there to unpack. But what's the thing that actually happens with Hosea and his wife?
He buys her.
Yeah. She's gone off into harlotry again, prostitution, sex slavery. And he goes and he buys her. He buys her out of the sex slavery. And he tells her, you're not going to run off from me again. Our marriage now represents God's reunion with Israel. But I want the explanation. Let's break that down. Verse 4. For the children of Israel shall dwell in the... So the children of Israel shall dwell for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. What period of time is that describing? What do you think?
When the Antichrist is ruling. Does this stop all the... Don't they start sacrificing?
This is to ephod and idols.
Yeah, there you go. So what do those things mean? Without king or prince... king or prince is pretty straightforward. Without sacrifice or pillar, what is that referencing?
Pillar of...
That's the one that I was thinking.
Yeah, it's sacrifice at the temple,
sacred,
right?
Sacred fertility pillar and line.
Yeah. Keep going with that.
It says sacred fertility pillar and line. I mean...
Without worshipping false gods. Right? sacrifice or pillar, fertility pillar, Asherah pole would be another way you might render it. Altar to a false god. And that gets explained even further without ephod or household gods. But they're references to both things that the people of Israel do to worship God. You know, Israel in the temple would make sacrifices. They had an ephod that the priest wore. But they did not have a fertility pillar or household gods that they worshiped. So he's saying there's going to be this time in Israel when God dwells with them and they don't have to have these methods of worshiping, right? Because God's going to be there. You see how I get there? Right? You're going to have this time where they will dwell with God. Listen, Hosea representing God, Gomer representing Israel, and they're going to be together. And so you won't have to have this intermediary way of worshiping God. You won't have to have sacrifices or pillars, ephod or household gods, king or prince. You're just going to be there with God. And then, afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. What period is being described in the afterward when the children of Israel seek the Lord their God and return and David the king?
The new stuff.
New Jerusalem, yes. So think back to when we studied the book of Revelation. You have Millennial Kingdom right here. And then, at the end of the Millennial Kingdom, what happens? We read Revelation 21. Yeah, Satan leads a rebellion that doesn't last very long. God snuffs them out as they're coming up on the city of Jerusalem. Great White Throne Judgment, New Jerusalem. That lines up. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return, seek the Lord their God, David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. As in, at the end of the Millennial Kingdom, there's going to be a brief rebellion, and then they're going to repent, come to God, and be ushered into eternity. Right? So we got the whole future history of the earth summarized there in two verses, Millennial Kingdom and Eternal State. It fits really well, is what I'm getting at. The other interpretation of this would be the first verse, children of Israel will dwell without kings or prince, without sacrifice, pillar, ephod, household gods, is referring to this time. And then the afterward refers to after the church is done, Israel repents and is ushered into the eternal state. Those people who say that we're living in the millennium right now. See, part of why people don't like studying the prophets is you have to have your eschatology straight. You have to know how things are fitting in, otherwise it's very confusing. So it might be good. We might do a refresher then. I'll hold that for later. The rest of the book of Hosea is sort of reiterating and restating what we've just been through in prophecy form instead of story form. So if you look at the outline, God sort of lays out his case against Israel. Why is he punishing them? Can anybody summarize that for me? Why is God going to punish Israel in a couple... They're prostitutes, meaning...
They're worshiping false gods.
They're worshiping false gods. Idolatry, yeah. Chapter 6 through 10, really in excruciating detail, describes the coming judgment for Israel. What is he going to do to them? And, of course, that is specifically talking about... Assyria. Assyrians coming in and destroying them in 722 BC. Then chapter 11 is this awesome chapter of God's grace in the middle of all this, where he promises them again future hope. Then he sort of repeats the judgment that's coming, and then he wraps up with the promises to the remnant. So we're going to sort of sprint through chapters 4 and 5, and then sprint through to the end of the book. And wrap it up with a nice, neat bow. Chapter 4. Somebody want to read 12 through 19 for me? He's laying out his case. So I've just pulled up. I highlighted a few sections that sort of really drive home the reason that they're being destroyed. In God's words. So, 12 through 19. Go for it.
They consult their wooden idols, and their diviner's staff answers with an oracle. The wind of prostitution blows them astray. They commit spiritual adultery against their God. They sacrifice on the mountaintops and burn offerings on the hills. They sacrifice under oak, poplar, and terebinth because their shade is so pleasant. As a result, your daughters have become cult prostitutes, and your daughters-in-law commit adultery. I will not punish your daughters when they commit prostitution, nor your daughters-in-law when they commit adultery. For the men consort there with harlots. They sacrifice with temple prostitutes. It is this, a people that lacks understanding will come to ruin.
Yeah, though you play the whore, O Israel, let not Judah become guilty. Enter not into Gilgal, go up to Beth Avan. Swear not, as the Lord lives. Like a stubborn heifer, Israel is stubborn. Can the Lord now feed them like a lamb in a broad pasture? Ephraim is joined to idols. Leave him alone when their drink is gone. They give themselves to whoring. Their rulers dearly love shame. What's going on in Israel?
Idolatry.
And very specifically, this is literal. They're literally going out and having temple prostitution rituals and literally going out and
expecting their daughters not to become prostitutes.
Correct.
Committing adultery.
Correct. And though you play the whore, O Israel, let not Judah become guilty. Sin. Just keep it in the north, guys. They don't. Just FYI. Don't spread this idolatry, this prostitution. 5:3-6. He starts talking to the priests now. I know Ephraim and Israel is not hidden from me. For now, O Ephraim, you have played the whore. Israel is defiled. Remember, Ephraim is just another word for Israel. Kind of like saying Houston or H-Town. Israel is defiled. Their deeds do not permit them to return to their God, for the spirit of whoredom is within them, and they know not their Lord. The pride of Israel testifies to his face. Israel and Ephraim shall stumble in his guilt. Judah also shall stumble with them. With their flocks and herds they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He has withdrawn from them. So this is part of where I wanted to think. They're going to get off into their idolatry so bad, and it's going to start being bad for them, and they're going to cry out, God, where are you? But what's the answer going to be?
Silence.
Silence. Right? They will not find him. And verse 15, I think that says the exact same thing. I will return again to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face, and then their distress earnestly seek me. So I'm going to wait.
Is that like... No. Never mind. Wrong time.
Okay.
Is it wrong time? When is this?
This is... Let's go back to our handy-dandy timeline. Right about... There.
So it could be like, sort of like when Daniel was looking at Jeremiah and said, like, the 700 years is up. Is this, that's when
that'd be
they
right
turn
here.
Their face?
Yes, that's when they earnestly seek him.
Okay.
When the judgment comes is when they start crying out to the Lord and he's not listening.
And then they earnestly seek
him. And they earnestly seek him with Daniel praying, yes.
You should use your other timeline.
Yeah, I need to make it into a PDF or a JPEG, but I haven't yet. Where are you? Look real quick at Deuteronomy 28. We've looked at Deuteronomy 28 before in here. Brief refresher, it's that chapter that everyone likes to quote from the first third of and not read the second two-thirds of. Because the first third is promises to Israel if they keep the law, and they're wonderful. Grain will be abundant, your flocks will be marvelously large, flowing with milk and honey. You're not going to want for anything. Life will be hunky-dory. I'm going to bless you beyond imagining. The second two-thirds are, if you don't follow the law, if you don't keep my commands, here's what's going to happen to you. And it's things like plagues, all of your crops are going to die, marauders of people are going to come through and kill everyone, they're going to rape your women, they're going to steal your kids and sell them to slavery. It's going to get so bad that you're going to resort to cannibalism. And in this time, you will seek after me, but you're not going to find me. That's verse 15. If you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and all the statutes that I command to you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, cursed shall you be in the field, cursed shall you be in your baskets and your kneading bowls, cursed shall you be in the fruit of your womb and the fruit of the ground and increase of your herds and the young flock. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out. Everything you do is going to be cursed. Specifically, so look at 31. So, we don't have time to do that. What's the point? They knew about this back when Moses was doing his thing. When Moses gave the law, when Joshua was repeating the law. Back here, it was told, follow the law, and if you don't, bad stuff's going to happen. Nations are going to come in, rape your women, kill you, take you off into slavery, and it's going to be awful.
You think this sort of led to the hardening of the Jews' hearts? Like, they were told to follow the law, they didn't, and then all this stuff happened, and now they're, like, so intent on trying to follow the law.
Yes.
That they miss the Messiah.
Yes, absolutely.
Dude, that's crazy.
I think another thing that was kind of interesting was Persia came before Assyria, and they were kind of relaxed. And I think some of them might have been like, oh, this isn't too bad. I mean, we were conquered, but, like, Persia didn't, like, force anything upon them. They weren't.
Persia came after Assyria.
It was after? What was the... Okay. I'm getting it all mixed up, though.
It went. Syria came first and sort of scattered them, but they'd also had interactions with all of the surrounding Akkadians, Ammon, and so they'd been paying them off and letting the surrounding nations let them do their thing. Syria did. Assyria comes in and actually conquers and destroys them. Then Babylon comes in and conquers and destroys Assyria and Judah. Then Persia comes in and destroys, conquers Babylon.
Syria is different than Assyria.
Yes. Yeah.
Gotta get these things straight. I know that they all exist. I keep moving around.
That's all right. It takes a little time to get it all straight in your mind. 6 through 10 is the coming judgment. Let's read 6, 1 through 3.
This is of Hosea?
Yes, of Hosea. Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us, that he may heal us. He has struck us down, and he will bind us up. After 2 days he will revive us, and on the third day he will raise us up, that we may live before him. Let us press on to know the Lord. His going out is sure as the dawn. He will come to us as the showers and as the spring rains that waters the earth. So what's the response of Israel when they hear about the judgment that's coming?
Let's try this again. Let's see if it goes any better.
But verse 4, what shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your love is like a morning cloud, like the dew that goes early away. Therefore I have hewn them by the prophets, I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and my judgment goes forth as the light, for I desire steadfast love, not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. But like Adam, they transgressed the covenant. There they dealt faithlessly with me. So what's his response?
Too bad, sir.
Yeah. You don't mean it.
Sucks me.
Where are you going to be 3 months from now?
So, you're just thirsty. You're not serious. What?
That's like a term now. Thirsty.
Oh.
That's like a term.
What's it a term for?
it's not a good one.
Like,
Oh,
not a good one.
Oh, okay. It's like a girl who's looking for a one-night stand.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what I was going to say, but I wasn't sure how to
okay.
Say
that's not what I meant. I just meant like you're thirsty, like you want a drink of water, and then you're going to go away. But that works too. They're also like that. They're not looking for a serious commitment.
They're also... I didn't realize how well that...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It works out.
So God's response is, you don't mean it. Like, you've had this chance before, you don't mean it. Judgment's coming anyway. As in, I will turn my heart, I will turn away, I will not listen. They will call out to me, I'm not going to listen. So that's what they do. Goes on quite a bit.
Here's a question.
Yeah.
Do you think he sped up time? Because he knew when they would earnestly seek him. Do you think he lives?
We're not doing that.
Do you think he sat there the whole time, waiting versus for someone to earnestly seek him? Or did he
chapter 8, verses 9 to 10. Starting verse 7. For they sow the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads, it shall yield no flower. If it were to yield, strangers would devour it. Israel is swallowed up already. They are among the nations as a used vessel, for they have gone up to Assyria, a wild donkey wandering. Ephraim has hired lovers. Though they hire allies among the nations, I will soon gather them up, and the king and princes shall soon ride because of the tribute. What event is that referring to? They hire allies among Assyria, among the nation. We talked about it last week when we went through the history of the kings.
Is it Hezekiah? I don't know. Where he took the gold and the silver from the temple and then he gave it to Assyria?
Yeah, Menahem. And Shalom, both, actually. They took the gold from the temple and they gave it to Assyria for protection. So that's what he's referring to. That's why we did the whole background thing where we marched through the kings, because there's actual references to it in the text when you're going through. Chapter 10, he continues on with the punishment that's coming. Obviously, if you're looking at this on paper, there's a lot that he goes into detail about what's coming, and it's really bad. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 8 sort of summarize it. Israel is a luxuriant vine that yields its fruit. The more his fruit increased, the more altars he built. As his country improved, he improved his pillars. Their heart is false. Now they must bear their guilt, and the Lord will break down their altars and destroy their pillars. For now, they will say, we have no king, for we do not fear the Lord. And a king, what could he do for us? They utter mere words. The empty oaths they make, with empty oaths they make covenants, so judgment springs up like poisonous weed in the furrows of the field. The inhabitants of Samaria tremble for the calf of Beth-Avon. Its people mourn for it. And so its idolatrous priests, those who rejoice over it and over its glory, for it has departed from them. The thing itself shall be carried to Assyria as tribute. Skip down to verse 15. Thus it shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great evil. At dawn the king of Israel shall be cut off utterly. So what's going to happen to Israel?
It will be wiped out.
It will be wiped out. Right after that, the king will be cut off utterly. Chapter 11, verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. The more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burnt offerings to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them by the cords of kindness with the bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. And I bent down to them and fed them. They shall not return to the land of Israel, but Assyria shall be their king. Because they have refused to return to me, the sword shall rage against them. Their cities consume them. How can I give you up? Verse 8. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah and treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst. I will not come in wrath. They shall go after the Lord. He will roar like a lion when he roars. His children shall come trembling from the west. They shall come trembling like birds from Egypt, like doves from the land of Assyria, and I will return them to their homes, declares the Lord. So what's God going to do in the end? Return them, yes.
Not destroy them.
Not destroy them. It's this, in the midst of judgment, mercy. This is something I want you to see throughout all the prophets. It's always in the midst of judgment, mercy. Specifically, whenever you study Hosea, you got to look at chapter 11, verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Does that ring a bell for anyone in the New Testament?
Yes, when Jesus fled,
their family fled to Egypt. Yeah. State, yeah. Matthew chapter 2. They go off to Egypt to avoid Herod's wrath when he's killing all the babies, right? So they live in Egypt for a few years, and then they come back to Nazareth, and that's how he was born in Bethlehem, went to Egypt, and then grew up in Nazareth. So verse 13, now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you. For Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and he took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. Out of Egypt I called my son. Now hold on. Chapter 11, verse 1 of Hosea is right in the midst of God promising judgment to Israel and then making a proclamation of mercy. So how is Jesus and his family fleeing to Egypt and coming back a fulfillment of this prophecy, the words, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son? If you're in the ancient time, and if you're in Hosea's time reading these words, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. What event are you thinking of that the writer means?
The Exodus.
It's got to be. Right? He's talking about the previous times when Israel was like a baby nation, when they're coming out of Egypt, and he called them. So how on earth can Matthew be saying...
Because here it says, the more I summon them, the farther they departed from me. Which, it would make no sense if it was talking about the return from Egypt.
Yeah, okay, but if it wasn't talking about the return from Egypt, what was it talking about for the first century audience? For Hosea's audience. When they read that, what do they think?
They think we...
So,
I don't know. That's
Joshua confusing.
Yeah. So... I'm sorry.
Israel was a young man. I loved him like a son, and I summoned my son out of Egypt, but the more I summoned them, why does it go from my son to them?
Yeah. Why does it switch from singular to plural? That's one big question that you should be asking. I think Hosea was actually talking about God making the promise to pull his Messiah out of Egypt. And so he's referencing a future event. And this is something that a little bit beyond you guys.
That Israel isn't a young man yet?
He just switched mid-sentence.
Yeah. The first half of verse 1, when Israel was a child, I loved him, is a statement of historical statement about Israel. The second half of the sentence, and out of Egypt I called my son, or out of Egypt my son will be called, would be a fair rendering of that sentence in Hebrew. So I think Hosea is actually talking about the future, when the Messiah will go off to Egypt with his parents, Mary and Joseph, and come back. And so when Matthew says this took place, when Matthew, telling the story about how Jesus went off to Egypt and came back, and says this took place to fulfill what the prophet wrote, out of Egypt I called my son, he's being totally literal, and he's reading Hosea correctly, as Hosea meant to be written. All that to say that. people argue about this, so I wanted to expose you to it. It's a little confusing, so don't beat yourself up if you're not following.
You could have worded it better.
And I actually think it's a double entendre. So Hosea is writing, knowing that the Messiah will be called out of Egypt as a prophetic word from God, but he's also using this as a theme of the Exodus.
But it's like and I summoned my son, but the more I summoned them, the farther they departed.
It's kind of like an aside. He was like, I loved Israel, like, while they were a young child, or like while they were in Israel or Egypt. Also, I'm going to call my son to Egypt, and then as I called them, more than they farther from me. It was like he just took apart the sentence to talk about Jesus coming out of Israel and then moved on. You have to word the sentence weird, but you can kind of swing it.
Yeah, well, and the thing is, it's a poetic device. It's a double entendre and a borrowed theme of Exodus.
Is summoned so using actually this, past tense there?
There's no past tense in Hebrew. That's the problem. There's perfect and imperfect.
Gotcha.
So
it's
imperfect.
Like summon, I summon, or am going to summon. It's not like.
Yes, sort of. It's has the action been completed, or has the action not been completed? But both of those can be future, or both of those can be past tense. So that you can use a future perfect, as in God will do this, he will complete this action, and is so sure that we say it in the perfect, or we can say it in the past tense, as God did this thing, and it's completed, and it's perfect.
It's like, I summoned my son, and he came to me, but the more I summoned you guys, the more you pulled away.
Yes.
Sort of thing.
Yes. Correct. He restates the judgment, chapter 12. I want to get into Joel, so we're just going to wrap this up. 14. Finishes this off with a plea. Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take with your words and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity, accept what is good, and we will pay with bulls and vows of our lips. Assyria shall not save us. We will not ride on horses. We will not say no more, our God, to the work of our hands. In you the orphan finds mercy. I will heal their apostasy. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned from them. I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall blossom like the lily. He shall take root for the trees of Lebanon. His shoots shall spread out. His beauty shall be like the olive, and his fragrance like Lebanon. They shall return and dwell beneath my shadow. They shall flourish like the grain. They shall blossom like the vine. Their fame shall be like the wine of Lebanon. O Ephraim, what have I told you to do with idols? It is I who answer and look after you. I am the evergreen cypress. From me comes your fruit. Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the upright walk in them, but transgressors will stumble in them. Who is God talking to with these promises? Easy answer.
Israel.
Israel, I'm going to restore you. And what's the last verse mean? Whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the upright walk in them. That's kind of the application of Hosea, is the last verse.
those who correctly know the prophecies are talking about are going to be prepared for the return of Jesus.
Correct. So yeah, you guys who are reading Hosea, back in Hosea's time, you're hearing the words of the prophet. What do? Well, you look at the ways of the Lord. You discern what he's saying. He's saying judgment's coming for you. So live rightly. Worship God with your heart. Don't worship idols. The upright walk in them, but the transgressors stumble in them. For us in our time, we read this. And what? How do we apply this?
The same way, except most of the Bible. And not really in the context of this judgment. I guess it's more of a wake-up call that God's word is his action.
Yes. Oh, that's a great statement. If you want to just like emblazon that, God's word is his action. That's part of the, like, what the prophets are all about. Yes. I like that. It's a recognize the word of God and that these things have come to pass and they will come to pass. What he has said is true and it will happen. And so live in light of that reality. Since some of these things haven't happened yet, right? They will. Believe that. That's.
I mean, that's pretty much the whole point of what all this is in.
Yeah.
Is to enforce what's in the latter half of the book.
Yeah. Right.
Give example. Adam.
We're gonna start into Joel. So take a deep breath. Shake it out. Hosea's done. Hosea is one of the longest minor prophets, so we actually get to dig in and look at more of the text for these other minor prophets. Hopefully it'll make more sense. Problem is, like, trying to balance getting through these quickly so that we're not just like stuck in two verses of a minor prophet for a month. But also making sure you get the gist of what they're about. Because they're very repetitive. As you saw in Hosea, it was like judgment, 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 mercy, judgment, 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 mercy. And it was just that. Repeated over and over again in hundreds of different ways. But it was basically judgment's coming, repent, and I will be merciful to the remnant. Lots of the prophets are like that. They're very repetitive. Joel is only 3 chapters long. So we can actually kind of dig into Joel a little bit. We'll just get through the introductory stuff today, and then we'll start into the text next week. But introductory issues, things like authorship, date, all that sort of stuff. Author is Joel. Verse 1 makes that pretty clear. The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. Date. 2 possible options. Either early 835 BC or very late 420s BC. And where does this line up? And I can't believe I didn't actually give you guys a timeline picture, so let's go back to.
So after Syria, before Syria.
Yeah, so either right in here, as in he's like the second prophet to write, or
after
the other option?
Babylon.
Very late 420s BC.
So lays it.
After the return. So which one is he? Technically speaking, we don't know. I think there's very good arguments, better arguments for the early date. That he's writing early, he's like the second prophet to write. We know he has to be writing after Obadiah, because he quotes Obadiah at one point. So we know he's writing after Obadiah. Obadiah is the first prophet to write, I think. And The reason is that is because the way that he describes what's coming for Israel and some of the stuff that he says is coming for Israel, it sounds like Babylon coming to, you know, take them into exile. So there's that. The audience is Judah, southern nation. That's clear in 2:32, 3:1, and 3:6. He specifically says, "Judah, listen." Who's he talking to? Judah. The purpose, very, very specific and unique, sort of, to the minor prophets, to explain the coming day of the Lord and cause Judah and Israel to repent. Specifically, it's that. Day of the Lord. If you want to summarize the book of Joel, you say the words, "Day of the Lord." So what's Joel about?
Day of the Lord.
Day of the Lord. It's the day of the Lord. Have you guys heard that phrase before, the day of the Lord?
No.
Yeah. No. It's pretty common in the prophets, most common in Joel. He's talking about the day of the Lord. And so we will we'll go through the background with the kings. So this is the history that's going on. And if you want to be like looking at a picture of Israel while we're talking about it. Essentially, instead of reading through all of 2 Kings like I did last time, which took so long, I went through and I summarized it in bullet points. But the sort of period of history when Joel's writing is 2 Kings 10 through 14. Right in here. Okay. And it's actually that whole thing about Jehu. His whole bloody rise to power. So, Ahab and Jezebel, you remember them? You remember the prophet who's sort of alive talking to Ahab and fighting against Ahab and Jezebel? Elijah, yeah. Ahab and Jezebel are strong Baal servants, worshiping Baal like crazy. Elijah challenges the prophets of Baal to a little test. You remember that? Mount Carmel.
Set a fire.
Yeah. You're going to stand out in the thing, you're going to call fire down from Baal, I'm going to call fire down from Yahweh, whoever's pillar lights up will win. And Elijah wins. Commands them all to be put to death, all the prophets of Baal. Jezebel then gets a little bit angry because Elijah went and led a little mini rebellion, killed all of her prophets. And so Elijah gets scared, runs off to... anybody?
The desert,
Mount Sinai.
Mountain.
Yeah, where Moses got the law, right? And he has the whole the wind, the cave experience, right? He was not in the wind, he was not in the fire. It was a still small voice, and he said, basically, "Go get Elisha," right?
That was the thing when it was like this bird that came.
Different time. So he says to Elijah, "Go find Elisha. Train him up as your replacement prophet," and so that's all going on. Elisha begins his prophetic ministry, and God tells him, "Anoint Jehu, king of Israel." So Elisha goes and he anoints Jehu, king of Israel. Jehu gets this word from God via Elisha, and God tells Jehu via Elisha, "You need to go in and take over Israel. You're king now." So Jehu does it. In stellar fashion, he is an army guy. He is a commander in one of the armies of Israel, and he sort of rounds up a gang and goes towards Jezreel. It's not on the map. He rounds up a gang, heads towards the capital, which Samaria, for all intents and purposes. The king of Israel at the time is Joram, so that's what KOI means, king of Israel. And the king of Judah at the time is Ahaziah. Ahaziah is Ahab's nephew, and Joram is Ahab's son. So these are the kings at the time. So following in Ahab's steps, both of them. Ahaziah is leading Judah astray in Baal worship like his aunt Jezebel. And Joram is following in his father's footsteps, Ahab, and worshipping Baal. not great guys at all. They are both hanging out in Samaria, and Jehu comes in, storms the castle, and kills them both. It's a fun passage to read. You should go read it. But it's Jehu's like, he's coming across the way with his army, and Joram sends a guy out to meet Jehu, and Jehu says, "Get out of here." And so they keep marching, and then Joram sends another guy out to meet Jehu, and Jehu says, "Get out of here, because I'm about to kill everybody." And so the guy runs off. And then Joram runs out to meet Jehu, and Jehu goes, "Hi." That's the Stephen abbreviated version. And then Ahaziah starts running back to the castle, and Jehu shoots him in the back with an arrow. It says the arrow went through him and stuck into his chariot. Jehu is a scary guy. He comes in, takes over the castle, lives in the castle, kills everybody, kills Jezebel, who is still living in the castle at the time.
So this is the guy that Jezreel is named after?
Yes. Yeah, it's in the Valley of Jezreel that Elisha anoints him king. Jehu kills all 70 of Ahab's relatives, including in Judah and Israel. Ahab and Jezebel have sort of set up their shop in the whole nation. Jehu kills all the Baal priests. We already talked about that. And Jehu is doing this under the instruction of the Lord. And so he is taking over Israel, being king, like he was anointed by Elisha. But he does not depart from the sins of Jeroboam. So he does not continue in Baal worship, but he does not return to worship of Yahweh. He is not a good guy. And great example of God using bad people to accomplish his purposes is the story of Jehu taking over Israel. Meanwhile, as Jehu is becoming king, and he goes on living, being king, I think, for about 26 years, Athaliah, the queen and mother of Ahaziah, the guy that Jehu shot in the back, right? Athaliah's queen down here, she finds out that her son Ahaziah has been killed by Jehu, and she thinks to herself, she is the sister of Ahab, she thinks to herself, I might be able to reunite the kingdom under Jehu. My son's dead, so I'm in charge of Judah right now. I'm going to go ahead and kill all my other kids. So she kills all of her other kids in an attempt to reunite the kingdom under Jehu. Problem is, one of her servants hides one of her kids, Joash. Takes him away, hides him in the temple with the priests. And so he lives for 6 years in hiding with the priests in the temple while Athaliah is queen of Judah and trying to reunite the nations. And the priest, at Joash's 7th birthday, brings the king out, Joash, says they have a whole coronation thing, and they kill Athaliah, and they put the 7-year-old on the throne, and they're like, all right, we got a new king in Judah, Joash. So Joash grows up and becomes king and reigns, and he does right in the eyes of the Lord, what the text says. He is a good king. He repairs the temple, because it's been neglected and run down and ruined under these Baal-worshipping Ahab relatives. He pays off, but this is where he doesn't do perfectly right. We get a little story of when he pays off the Arameans from the temple treasuries, and his servants then conspire and kill him. And so then his son Amaziah reigns in his place after he's killed. So this is kind of the history that's going on while Joel is writing. How might you describe this history?
Fast-paced.
Intriguing, if nothing else. Tumultuous, I think, would be a good word for it.
Chaotic.
This is Israel and Judah. This is if you just sit down and read the Book of Kings. It's engaging. Two other things that
it's
are
like
going on.
Small kingdom warfare.
Yeah.
Exactly what it is.
Exactly. It's the Game of Thrones. Under Jehu, the nations of Israel and the nation of Judah are not thriving particularly economically. God is not blessing them. They are losing ground. So their borders shrink under Jehu to about like this. And the surrounding nations sort of gain ground on them. And one of the things that goes on during this time is recorded in archaeology, which is why you got either the early or the late date, is a massive locust plague. huge locust plague that just devastates the land. Yeah. And so that's how these two dates kind of get mentioned, because there's a massive locust plague in the early 800s and there's a massive locust plague in the 420s. So it's like, it's probably one of those two. Now we narrow it down based on the internal evidence in the book. And so we'll start into the text and then we'll pick it up here next week. Jehu starts out with a word from the Lord. Hear this, you elders, give ear, all inhabitants of the land. Has any a thing happened in your days or in the days of your fathers? Has anything like this happened in your days? Anything like what? Verses 4 through 7. When the cutting locust left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust left, the hopping locust has eaten. And what the hopping locust left, the destroying locust has eaten. So we got three waves of locusts and absolutely nothing is left now. Awake, you drunkards, and weep, and wail, all you drinkers of wine, because of the sweet wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. For a nation has come up against my land, powerful and beyond number. Its teeth are like lion's teeth, and it has fangs of a lioness. Has laid waste my vine and splintered my fig tree. It has stripped off their back and thrown it down. Their branches are made white. So he uses this locust plague as an illustration for what's coming. And in particular, it's a nation, an army, that's going to come and destroy the nation of Israel. Surprise, that's what most of the prophets are about. Destruction is coming. So has anything like this happened in your time? Anything like what? Verse 4, anything like this locust plague happened? And by illustration, this locust plague is describing an army, a nation that has come up against my land, powerful beyond number.
Like several armies.
Yeah. So that is where we'll pick up on this slide next week.
How many locust waves were there?
Three.
Three.
The cutting locust, the swarming locust, and the hopping locust.
And then the destroying.
Oh, there's four, sorry. Yeah, you're right. Four. Cutting, swarming, hopping, destroying. So Joel, next week we'll get into Joel and we will talk about the Day of the Lord, because that's a fun topic. I would encourage you to go back and sort of refresh the eschatology lesson that we did. It's on the website. If you have your eschatology stuff straight, it makes the discussion of the Day of the Lord a lot more engaging and fun. So real quick, I'll show you how to get there, and then we'll break.
The lion
to mygiveonthings.com.
The leopard and the beast, or was there one more?
Lion, bear, leopard, beast. That's right. Home group.
That's
so you
four.
you go to the home group tab, and you go down here to systematic theology, and then. Lesson 12, eschatology, and you can watch it, and it's wonderful. And you can laugh at your voice on tape from back then, because it'll sound different than it does now.
So do you think
that the trailers... I don't think it's changed that.
Do you think that the trailers
have
changed the message that
we're
going
to have? So we have 1 week for eschatology?
Yes.
Yeah, I sound the same, I know.
So you think the four waves of locusts could be the same as the four kingdoms coming through?
Hey, look, the clock is in the same place.
No way.
That is one major interpretation.
Unless Batman were to have on glasses, then it would show that.
Okay.
I have passed.
Hopefully, y'all will like Joel better than you liked Hosea, because I could tell some.
Was it
less than enthused?
Stay on it very long.
Yeah. We'll do Joel and Amos, Joel, Obadiah. Probably be able to, Obadiah is one chapter. So we'll probably do all of Obadiah next week.
You regret giving me up for?